About 2 months after the Buddha attained enlightenment, which could be defined as total freedom from suffering. About 2 months after he attained total freedom from suffering, he gave his first Dharma discourse in a place in Sarnath, India, called the Deer Park. He gave this first Dharma discourse to five friends of his that he had been practicing with for some years. And he said, one of the things that he said, maybe the thing that he actually started with in his talk, was, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." The Buddha taught that suffering is intrinsic to the human condition, or at least it's intrinsic to the human condition until we wake up to the true nature of our life, the true nature of life, the true nature of ourself. That until we wake up, when we do wake up, we realize that suffering isn't the truth of the human condition. Hard to believe sometimes. When the Buddha said that when he said, "I teach suffering," he wasn't recommending suffering. He wasn't about to teach us the best way to suffer. He was really only pointing out the truth of its existence, and that until we look directly and honestly at the reality of suffering in our lives, we aren't able to take the necessary steps to free ourselves from it. I think that maybe the most subtle and the most deeply pervasive aspect of suffering is the suffering that's inherent in ignoring the truth that everything in this world, everything in this universe, comes into being through the combination of many, many conditions. Suffering is a conditional aspect of life. It's not an absolute. But we very often take it to be the opposite. We take it to be solid, to be permanently in place, to identify ourselves through it, to separate it out from the whole of things as the truth, as a solid, absolute thing, experience. Where I live in New Mexico, up in the mountains, there are very often rainbows appearing. And I live in such a place where I see the whole of the rainbow, sometimes double rainbows, from one beginning of the arc all the way through to the end of the arc. Huge rainbows. A rainbow appears because of certain conditions coming together. There's just the right amount of moisture in the air, in the atmosphere. The way the light is, the angle of the light is just right. And me, or anybody else who's seeing it, happening to be in the right place at the right time and looking in the right direction. And it all changes very, very quickly. Everything in life, including ourselves, is like a rainbow. Merely a set of constantly changing conditions, totally interrelated and empty in and of themselves, empty in and of ourself, not separate. And it's very obvious with rainbows. But not so obvious with the more solidly appearing phenomena, both the physical and mental phenomena of our rainbow body, our rainbow mind, our rainbow heart. The suffering, experiencing suffering of a state of mind, a phenomena, ideas, various experiences, and identifying it as who we are and solidifying it in our mind as alone, all by itself, very real, very unchanging entity. It can be ideas, opinions, our beliefs about this or that, emotional states, sensations. If we solidify it, it will inevitably bring suffering. But the way of things, the natural way of things, the way the natural laws operating in the unfolding of life will inevitably get in the way and frustrate our efforts to try to hold on, try to solidify and hold on to this or that, to anything actually. We can't be free from something that we don't see. We can't be free from something that we ignore. There's a saying in English, ignorance is bliss. From the Buddhist perspective, ignorance is ignorance. It's not bliss. Bliss is bliss. Ignorance provides the fertile ground for delusion to sprout. But fortunately for us, ignorance and delusion are only impermanent, conditioned states of suffering. They're not our true nature. They're just one of the hues of the rainbow. As we gently bring the eyes of mindfulness and the heart of loving kindness and compassion, seeing all of the hues, including the darkness, the dark hues, the more difficult hues, begin to see them all with the light of mindfulness and the heart of loving kindness and compassion. And we can actually then begin to call it, as a writer named Mae Sarton says, call it seasonal, not harsh or strange, simply seasonal. There's a country singer, I don't know if anybody over here hears of her, named Dolly Parton. Maybe you have. Yes, you have. Well, you never know where your wisdom's going to come from. This is a quote from Dolly Parton. She says, if you want to be a rainbow, you have to put up with the rain. So sometimes we have to put up with the rain, and sometimes it pours. Thunders and lightning, big storms. It's part of being a rainbow. It's really a courageous choice that we make when we make the choice to transform our mind, transform our heart, so that we actually embody love, embody compassion. It's a choice to not turn away, to not run away. It's a choice to actually be here, be still, and be in relationship with whatever is. It's a very courageous choice. We begin to see, we begin to actually experience the power of the heart, of the mind-heart, and our very natural, completely natural, inherent ability to love, to heal, to grow, to change, to connect. Today in one of the groups, someone was speaking about the way she uses words and the phrases and a kind of essence in Hebrew. And the word heal, healing, being synonymous with metta. It's our natural capacity. So, this evening I'd like to spend some time with you looking at some of the hues of the rainbow. Some of the hues of the rainbow that are sometimes more difficult to look at, that show up in our metta practice and in our vipassana practice. So we'll begin with a story about the Buddha. Towards the end of the long night of this person, Siddhartha Gautama, his name before he became the Buddha, towards the end of his long night sitting under the Bodhi tree, Mara appeared. Mara is the personification of all of the dark and or potentially obstructive forces of mind, of heart. And Mara had been shooting arrows, poison arrows, at the Buddha, hoping they would stick, the arrows of delusion, the arrows of desire, of aversion, distraction. But none of them stuck. Finally, Mara shot the last arrow at this about-to-be Buddha, and hoping it would really stick in firmly. It was the arrow of doubt, the arrow of self-doubt. And Mara spoke to the Buddha and said, "What makes you think you have the right to be sitting here, where you are, how you are? Just who do you think you are, anyway?" And this about-to-be Buddha, with his great, deep confidence, his lion-like fearlessness, his open-hearted loving-kindness, compassion, and his amazing grace. He simply reached with his hand down to the ground, touched the earth with the tips of his fingers, letting Mara know that the earth was bearing witness to his right to be sitting how and where he was. And at that moment, Mara was defeated, never again to return to the almost Buddha. And it's our right, just the same. It's our right to be sitting how and where we are at any given moment. It's said that actually, let me back up a little bit. The root of doubt, the last arrow that Mara shot, hoping it would stick, the root of doubt, the contraction of doubt, is actually based in fear. Fear disguised as doubt. We feel in those moments like we can't open, we won't open. We won't attend to. We can't be with. We feel kind of frozen. We feel contracted. Maybe we feel lost or quite confused. Kind of this feeling of not being able to take another step, another breath, another phrase, another look. And so sometimes at this point, we engage in doubt, doubting the practice, doubting the teachings, and the most painful of all, doubting ourselves, blaming ourselves, doubting ourselves, which is really one of the most painful experiences of our human condition. Self-doubt. It's said in the teachings that one of the very last things to go is what's called conceit. Now, usually we think of conceit as a person who's, at least in English, a person who's conceited thinks they're better than everybody else. But in the way that it's looked at in these teachings is that conceit means feeling better than, or feeling less than, not good enough, not as good as, or comparing, the comparing mind. So when we feel less than, it's a place of self-centeredness. That's what conceit means. We're selfing, I sometimes call it. We're creating a self that's not as good as, that's better than, that constantly compares with others. The Buddha said, it's the self by which we suffer. That's the place wherein we suffer the most, as we create these selves and get stuck in these selves. So this place of doubting, this place of doubting one's self, not good enough, not right, not okay, based in fear, Often we're afraid to look at the fear, and we get quite attached to the doubt. We believe it, and we get lost in it. We're afraid to look directly at the fear. And especially maybe if we've taken a peek and we've seen it's not so easy to look directly at fear. And maybe in the past, when fears come up, we haven't had an avenue, a way of looking at it with some help, some reflection, some kind of support in difficult times. And it's very true, we do have to do it ourselves. No one can do it for us. But it is really important to have help along the way. A situation like this where we have, in the silence, wonderful, strong support of other people. And also the potential of meeting with teachers, if that's a needed help at any time. But sometimes we haven't had that help, and so we are afraid. We don't have a way to look. If we get caught in doubting, if we take it as our primary relationship to our practice, to our life, then on a deeper level, we're actually living in and out of fear. But as we get stronger in our practice, as we get stronger with the development of a loving heart, a compassionate heart, as our mindfulness gets stronger and we're seeing more clearly with the ground of loving kindness and friendship for ourselves, we can begin to actually open to fear. It's come up in some of the group meetings. When fear comes really strong, the potential of actually opening to it and seeing what it is. We don't need to be so bound, so imprisoned by it. We don't need to live so shut off to the unknown, which means we're actually shut off to a huge, vast range of possibilities. So as we get stronger through our practice, we can begin to acknowledge the presence of fear and accept that it is. And know that it's not a solid thing. Know that it comes and goes. Know that it isn't who we are. Know that it doesn't need to run our life, doesn't need to take us over. We begin actually then to lose the fear of fear and begin to look it in the eye, so to say. This is a piece from a book from the Sierra Club. It's a book about elephants. It's called The Fate of the Elephant. We came upon a young male lion with two lionesses. They were working their way toward a Maasai with his herd of cattle. As they drew closer, they began to belly along through the grass, then crouch to eye the cattle. The young male started growling. He switched his tail with excitement. He half rose to coil for a running start several times. "We'd better help that man," I said. "No," Tim said firmly. "He knows the lions are there. This is for him to do. He would not want us to interfere." The herder stood staring straight at the cats and slowly raised his spear to a throwing position without once moving his gaze away. From a distance, the other herders who had noticed the man's posture drew nearer to watch the standoff, but not too near. They too thought that this was for him to do. This was what he had been trained for as a herder. Each time the male lion growled and poised itself, the man would shake his spear and spread his stance a bit. Each time the cat was still, the man was still, matching the animal's steadfast, golden-eyed stare. The standoff continued for a quarter of an hour. At last, the lions crouched away into a line of thorn scrub. Had the herder communicated the slightest hesitation or fear, I think they would have gone for his cattle in a flash. If these youngish lions hadn't known much about the Maasai when they started, they knew something now, and it might help them survive among people in the future. A surprise ending. And this is another piece written by a Native American Indian. It's called The Fear of Botali. Botali rode easily among his enemies. Once, twice, three and four times, and all who saw him were amazed, for he was utterly without fear, so it seemed. But afterwards he said, "Certainly I was afraid. I was afraid of the fear in the eyes of my enemies." A Dharma friend and a student of mine in Taos died of AIDS-related complications just about a year ago. He talked, he was a very devoted practitioner, and he talked about the virus being his friend, his ally in awakening. He said that the virus was his inspiration to wake up and to live, to really, really live right now with loving kindness, compassion, awareness, moment to moment, in and out of very difficult experiences, in the midst of pain, anger, fear. Here's a little, he was also a writer, and this is a little piece from an article he wrote. On the last full day of the retreat, during walking meditation, I was overwhelmed with sadness for all humanity and for the planet. I cried and cried in pain. How can there ever be an end to suffering? And then I stopped and looked up at the mountain ridge behind the retreat center and repeated metta to myself, for all beings, repeated metta for myself, for all beings, for the planet. The empathy was still there, but I saw it more clearly as part of the whole and was thankful for my ability to transform the pain, to begin opening to my compassionate heart. And then he goes on, having regrets about my past or fears about my future are just thoughts in the moment. I am only who I am at any given moment. I have learned on a cellular level that vipassana and metta and dharma and the sangha are in and around me, as is AIDS, as is my treatment, as is my journey. In the last month of Roy's life, or last month and a half, he was in the hospital for the month, and then went home for the last 2 weeks. And during that month in the hospital, he asked people to come and sit with him. And so I was there pretty much every day for a certain period of time, and we sat together. And his practice was metta. That was his choice. I felt like he really needed to choose how he wanted to practice. And so it was metta, and we did metta every day. And we adjusted the phrases to be appropriate, and he was part of that. We discussed whether we should say them out loud, sometimes silently, whatever he wanted. He asked the Sangha to come and sit with him. So every day there were some people who came and sat with him. Some days he was so sick that they wouldn't let anybody in the room. And there's a little chapel in the hospital in Taos that nobody ever really goes into. So Sangha members that came to sit with him would go sit in the chapel and sit with him in the chapel, and he would be told that they were there and they were sitting. I had to leave to go to India just a couple of days after he came out of the hospital. He wanted to go home, and he was quite sure he was dying, so he wanted to go home and die. And people were with him round the clock, sitting. All he wanted to do during that last 2 weeks pretty much was sit. People said that he became translucent, just clear. And those that were with him when he died said that he died in a very clear, pure state of loving kindness, of compassion. An amazing experience, an amazing teaching. An amazing inspiration. Each one of us knows all the various faces or hues of the rainbow of difficult emotional states. And as we begin to know them more clearly, more directly, we begin to know that they're fear, anger, desire, are based on our dislike of some aspect of our experience. Sometimes we feel anger, for instance, or irritation towards an object that's present here now, or towards one that's very, very far away. And sometimes we experience great anger, great fear, great sadness, or even great desire over past events that are long, long gone, and that there's absolutely nothing we can do about anymore. And amazingly, to me amazingly anyways, we can get enraged or terrified or feel very strong desire for something that hasn't even happened and spend an enormous amount of time and energy in that place with something that hasn't even happened. There's something that we imagine might happen. We don't know. There's a story about a monk who lived in a cave, and he was a very skillful painter. He spent, it said, a number of years painting a tiger on the wall of his cave. He did a beautiful job, very realistic. And when he finally finished, he sat back to look at this painting of the tiger that he'd made that was so real it was almost alive, but it was a painting. And he sat and sat and sat looking at the tiger, and he became more and more terrified of this tiger in his cave. So terrified, it said that he scared himself to death. Well, we do that. in various ways in our life also. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what are called the near and far enemies of loving kindness. The near enemy, and meaning by near enemy, it looks like, but isn't. Strong desire, greed, attachment, possessiveness, sometimes looks like loving kindness. We think it's loving kindness. Desire, strong desires, greed, grasping, clinging, attachment. These are states of mind, states of heart, that define what we think we need in order to be contented, in order to be at ease in our life. And so sometimes we live our life projecting our hopes and our dreams of fulfillment into some object or some kind of future, or what we want to be, or how we want to become, how we want to be related to, how we want to be seen. And live in that place of wanting a lot of the time. And sometimes it feels like it's love. There's this energy that sometimes feels like that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Desire in the mind, in the heart, is sometimes likened to a pond that's been filled with dye. And we can't see the bottom anymore. Can't see the bottom of the pond. Our vision is obscured because of the dye. In contrast to metta, in contrast to loving kindness, this force of love that melts, that dissolves barriers, that enhances the natural brightness, enhances the natural clarity, luminosity of the heart, of the mind. The opposite, really, of that cloud of desire. Strong desire creates a kind of divisiveness, dividing, a duality, a separation. It creates attachment and clinging in that division. And so for this reason, it's considered one of the hindrances to metta, one of the things that gets in the way of metta. An unawareness, if we live with unawareness, with no awareness of the consequences of blindly, unconsciously following our desires, and desire is a natural human condition. I mean, it's what brought you here in some way. It's healthy, you know, in some way. We need it. It's part of us. But we're also blinded by it when we're not conscious and clear and confused about what it actually is. If we blindly and unconsciously follow our desires, it may be that we hurt someone else in that, or hurt ourselves. And we may become very dependent on having certain objects of our desire and hope for or depend on them to remain the same or do what we want them to do And we might spend a good deal of our time pursuing or trying to recreate these changing objects of our desire. We often think that the satisfaction of this or that desire will give us something that in fact it won't, that it can't. We live in delusion. Illusion. So I think a really good question to ask ourselves every now and then is, how driven am I by my desires? I'd like to give you an experience that I had, very simple experience around desire, share it with you. Sometimes we're very clearly, directly, and simply with pleasant experience, enjoying something. But sometimes in the midst of pleasant experience, we suffer in relationship to pleasant experience. So one day I was smelling a flower. I like flowers and I like the smell of them. So I was smelling this really sweet, beautifully sweet smelling flower, enjoying it. And then I noticed that I was beginning to lean towards the experience with a kind of greedy, grasping feeling inside of me. Now, sometimes we mistaken that feeling for love, for pleasant. But I was really looking at it, really practicing with it. And I noticed that there was contraction. I was contracting. And I really wasn't any longer purely and clearly enjoying the smell of the flower anymore. I wanted more of it. I wanted it not to stop. I didn't want to, I had this feeling of staying there. I didn't want to, I had to go do something, get up and walk away. I wanted it, And there's this, it's very subtle, but I was kind of closing around it, and it wasn't pleasant anymore. Even though the smell was still there, I'd lost that pure connection with the joy and enjoyment of the smell. It happens very, very quickly that we mistaken attachment, yearning and grasping, for pleasure. It's a really interesting one. So watch it sometimes. It happens very quickly. And it's a very deep habit, a very pervasive habit with all of us. We're really not clear in what's happening in that process. Not clear in our relationship to the experience until we begin to see it clearly. So the experience of this sweet smell of the flower is over. It's gone. And I'm still grasping onto it. The memory of it, clinging to it, wanting it back, wanting it again, wanting more of it, imagining it, fantasizing, which a moment ago was just a moment of pleasantness, no longer pleasant. Caught in the grip in my own habitual wanting mind. As we actually begin to see clearly, experiencing attachment, grasping, we find out we're experiencing a kind of tension, a kind of stress, and it's a suffering. Sometimes it's really overt and strong, and sometimes it's very subtle. There's confusion, there's delusion that this yearning, this state of desire, this state of attachment feels good. until we begin to see it, it's actually a burning. It actually burns. The Buddha described suffering, and particularly desire and grasping and clinging, as burning. And there's an expression in English called burning with desire. It burns. So how much are we run by my desires? How much are you run by your desires? How driven am I by my desires? They come, they go. It's worth taking a look, because it clarifies a lot of our relationship to life. So the near enemy of loving kindness is greed, attachment, possessiveness. Looks like metta. Feels, we think that's what it is. And in order to know the truth of things, we need to take a look. I'd like to speak just briefly about anger or aversion. In the form of anger, because that also comes up in our metta practice. And anger can color our entire experience. When we're caught in anger, nothing is right, nobody's right. When we're swept away in these states of mind, we often feel quite restless in our body, quite restless in our mind, quite restless in our heart. And it's hard to be present with the phrases of loving kindness. It's hard even to be present with the intention to explore the experience with the spirit of discovery when we're caught. When anger is really strong, to really understand it, we need to come very close to it, to investigate it, without pushing it away or without pulling away from it, without desiring it to be different. So it's important to learn how to be with and practice with these states, even within a metta practice, because we get to see in metta practice what's not metta. It comes up. There are a number of ways to work with these states of mind. And as I've spoken about within the metta practice, when strong states of mind come up, to move to the vipassana practice, to move to mindfulness, a mindful relationship with what's happening. Mindfulness is really an amazing tool. And sometimes it seems almost like magic. It's a great protection. With awareness, with a mindful awareness, we can allow these strong energies to teach us how they operate, to teach us their laws, the conditions that they operate in. And we can actually learn to experience the extremes of these energies without getting caught up in them, without getting swept away in them, without being overcome by them. There's a poem by a man named David White And it's actually about grief, not about anger, but they're often very closely related, grief and anger. It's called the well of grief. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear. Nor will they find in the darkness, glimmering, the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. And following this with another poem called Crying. Crying only a little bit is no use. You must cry until your pillow is soaked. Then you can get up and laugh. Then you can jump in the shower and splash, splash, splash. Then you can throw open your window and say, ha, ha, ha. And if people say, hey, what's going on up there? Ha, ha, sing back. Happiness was hiding in the last tear. I wept it. Ha, ha. Those are the small round coins thrown in the well by those who wished for something else. Learning to cultivate the opposite states is a very powerful antidote, a remedy, a healing from anger. Equanimity. By learning to do this, by bringing in more strength and balance of heart, by learning to do this, we weaken these emotional states and begin to unhook ourselves from being caught by them. If these energies are weaker and happen less and less often, we can then more easily be with them with a mindful attention. As I've said a number of times, metta and fear, anger, strong desire can't exist in the heart mind at the same moment. It's a courageous choice to make the choice to transform our heart and mind so that we actually embody love and compassion. That choice to really be present with what is, with our very natural deepening and growing capacity of heart, unconditional love, compassion, this ability to grow, heal, connect ourselves, other beings. It's our completely natural and inherent human quality. This is a quote that I really like. Comes from a black American man. And it was it's from a service that was given on Father's Day at a black Catholic church in Baltimore, Maryland. And in this church, on Father's Day, an African-American congregation, all-black congregation, the men came in to this this day of this celebration. They had a ceremony called the Procession of Warriors. And the minister spoke. And one of the things he said was this: "You're not a man because you killed somebody," he said to a chorus of amens. "You're a man when you know how to heal somebody." We must say, even from our experience, brother, you're not a man if you can make a baby. You're a man when you learn how to raise a baby. That's when you become a man. The power of love. As I think I've mentioned, I know I've mentioned, I've taught in Poland two different periods of time fairly recently. And 3 years ago when I first taught there, I was there for 2 months. And during that 2 months, I spent some time at Auschwitz. There was a retreat going on in Auschwitz that maybe some of you have heard of. That was the first year. It's gone on for 3 years now. It just happened recently again. An American Zen Roshi, Bernie Glassman, another Jewish Buddhist, he created this retreat at Auschwitz. And he the first year, he did it on American Thanksgiving in November. It hasn't been on the Thanksgiving holiday the last 2 years. But I went there the first year. And I was only there for a few days because I had commitments I had to get back to in Przeszeka in Poland where I was teaching. There were about 140 people there from all over the world. Jews, non-Jews, for lots of different reasons, people came to that. And one of the things we did in the evening, each evening, there was a reading. And the reading was from a diary that some of you may know of, Etty Illesum's diary, who was a Dutch Jewish woman, a 27-year-old woman, who spent some time at Auschwitz and one of the other camps. And so different pieces of her diary were read in the evening. She was an amazing person. And during these years of incredible suffering all through Europe, she went through an enormous personal growth. It was really for her a time of liberation, personal liberation, in the midst of enormous suffering. So her diaries are an account of the human possibility in the midst of immense, extreme difficulty. So I'd like to read a couple of pieces from her diary. "I think I'll do it anyway. I'll turn inward for half an hour each morning before work and listen to my inner voice. Lose myself. You could call it meditation. I'm still a bit wary of that word, but anyway, why not? A quiet half hour within yourself. But it's not so simple, that sort of quiet hour. It has to be learned. A lot of unimportant inner litter and bits and pieces have to be swept out first. Even a small head can be piled high inside with irrelevant distractions. So let this be the aim of meditation, to turn one's innermost being into a vast, empty plain, with none of that treacherous undergrowth to impede the view, so that something of God can enter you, and something of love, too. Not the kind of love deluxe that you revel in deliciously for half an hour, taking pride in how sublime you feel, but the love that you can apply to small, everyday things. And then at another point in the diary, she wrote, "Mysticism must rest on crystal clear honesty and can only come after things have been stripped down to their naked reality." Eddie, she knew that she wouldn't return from the camps. She had a really clear perception. And so she asked, while she was still alive, she asked some of her friends to keep her diary. Because she had some sense that that it would be important to her, for her solutions to what was going on would be important to people in some way at some later time. And so her diaries were kept, fortunately. This is from the very last entry of her diary. "Ever since last night, I've been lying here, trying to assimilate just a little of the terrible suffering that has to be endured all over the world. To accommodate just a little of the great sorrow the coming of winter has in store. It could not be done. Today will be a hard day. I shall lie quietly and try to anticipate something of all the days that are to come." And then she closes with this: "When I suffer for the vulnerable, is it not my own vulnerability that I really suffer?" And her last line is, "We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds, our own and others." That's my line, not hers. People from the camps said that she was an incredibly luminous personality all the way through her time there, to the very last. This energy of loving kindness, of compassion, the light of the energy, the power of the energy, can shine itself like the full moon and reflect in everything that we do. All the hues of the rainbow, allowing us to really be more fully in this rainbow life, in this rainbow body, this rainbow heart, the whole of this rainbow life with all of its hues. I'd like to close with a poem that I hope I have. Too many papers here. Maybe I don't. I do. This is a poem called Hokusai Says. Hokusai was a Japanese painter, Zen painter, and he painted, his most famous painting is this great big painting of one big wave. Some of you have probably seen it. Hokusai says, "Look carefully." He says, "Pay attention, notice." He says, "Keep looking, stay curious, He says there's no end to seeing. He says look forward to getting old. He says keep changing. You just get more who you really are. He says get stuck. Accept it. Repeat yourself as long as it's interesting. He says keep doing what you love. He says keep praying. He says every one of us is a child. Every one of us is ancient. Every one of us has a body. Every one of us, he says, every one of us is frightened. He says every one of us has to find a way to live with fear. He says everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees. Wood is alive. Water is alive. Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside us. He says, live with the world inside you. He says, it doesn't matter if you draw or write books. It doesn't matter if you saw wood or catch fish. It doesn't matter if you sit at home and stare at the ants on your front porch or the shadows of the trees and the grasses in your garden. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. Contentment is life living through you. Joy is life living through you. Satisfaction and strength is life living through you. Peace is life living through you. He says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Look, feel. Let life take you by the hand. Let life live through you. So let's sit together for a moment.